House State Affairs Committee will please come to order. Excuse a little bit of the delay. We had some technical difficulties, but our folks over there got it all straightened out. Would you please call the roll?
Representative Keller?
Here.
Representative Millett?
Here.
Representative Christ Hawkins?
Here.
Representative Gaddis?
Here.
Representative Hughes?
Here.
Representative Isaacson?
Here.
Chair Lynn?
Here. And again, good morning, everybody. Welcome. We have three items on the agenda today. We're going to go a little bit out of order because we have to be flexible around this place. So we're going to start, I believe, with SJR 10, Arctic Policy, U.S. Coast Guard, and the Arctic Council. Number two will probably be HCR 3, dealing with the Joint Committee on Federal Overreach. Excuse me. And number three will be HB 59, Missing Vulnerable Adult Response Plan. And so if the representative of SJR 10 will come forward, do we have a change in plans?
No.
Okay, good. please come forward here. Okay. Good morning. Please introduce yourself to the committee. We all know you, but our vast viewing audience may not.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Senator Kathy Geisel. I represent District N. That's Turnagain Arm in the north half of the Kenai Peninsula. And with me is my legislative aide from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, Joe Burns. I'll let him introduce himself.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chair, my name is Joe Burns. I am from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I'm here as a University of Alaska intern working in the Senator's office. And I will be presenting the bill, or excuse me, the resolution for her.
Very good. Appreciate you being here, and I'm going to direct the committee to ask all the difficult questions to you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I believe that before you, before us today is a House committee substitute.
Yeah, and first we need to adopt the CS, or somebody please make a motion.
I don't have it in front of me yet, so somebody else is ready.
As we feverishly turn the pages here. Yeah.
You want me to make a motion for you?
Huh?
You want me to make the motion
for
you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I ask that we adopt the CS for House CS for Senate Joint Resolution 10 State Affairs 28-LS054-C.
Okay. An objection for discussion?
I'll object for discussion.
Fine. Thank you. Please please present.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I'm going to have my intern, Joe Burns, present the bill. He has done a great job on it, and I'll let him do the presentation.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, broadly speaking, Senate Joint Resolution 10 considers the overall Arctic policy of the United States with particular emphasis on how that policy relates to Alaska. Specifically, SJR 10 recognizes the U.S.'s inclusion of a representative from Alaska on the increasingly influential Arctic Council, urges Congress to expand the existing U.S. Coast Guard icebreaker fleet to maintain its growing Arctic responsibilities, and finally advises the U.S. to assert its political, strategic, environmental, and economic interests in the Arctic by pursuing America's vast diplomatic, military, and economic means. Globally, we see renewed interest in the Arctic because of the diminishing levels of polar sea ice presenting new opportunities to the world. Geologists believe that the Arctic holds the potential for large quantities of natural resources that could promote domestic energy security and the Alaskan economy. The decline in the amount of polar sea ice is also presenting commercial interests with the opportunity to reduce international shipping times compared to conventional routes by navigating the Arctic Ocean. Though the rest of the world appears to recognize the potential of the Arctic, there has been relatively inadequate resolve exhibited at the federal level in advancing our Arctic interests. If you turn your attention to the page titled Major Icebreakers of the World, which should be in your packets, this paper published by the U.S. Coast Guard reveals how our neighbors have demonstrated their Arctic interests. Icebreakers are essential to carrying out Arctic operations and projecting a nation's presence in northern waters. As you can see, Russia has 17 state-operated icebreakers, Canada has 6, and the U.S. has 3 Coast Guard icebreakers, only one of which is presently in service. U.S. interests are at stake in the Arctic, and these interests are of particular concern to Alaskans. International art policy affects Alaskans uniquely compared to any other American. To preserve Alaskan interests, SJR 10 highlights Alaska's engagement with the Arctic Council. Since its inception in 1996, this international high-level forum has emerged as the leading channel for the discussion of international Arctic affairs among the Arctic states. We believe that Alaska's Arctic interests are fundamentally America's Arctic interests, and whatever avenue we have available to convey those interests should be pursued. Our nation should seek to unlock the Arctic's potential by having the U.S. take a leadership role in guiding international Arctic policy. And our belief is that by adopting the provisions of SJR 10, that would be a good first step in advancing that goal. And that concludes my prepared remarks.
Thank you very much. Does this have anything whatsoever to do with the Law of the Sea, a treaty that's being proposed by various folks?
SJR 10 does not specifically promote or oppose the...
It's neutral on it.
Yeah.
Fine. Any questions from the committee? We've got to think of something to ask him.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Millett.
Why does Argentina, Chile, and South Africa have an icebreaker? I just find that very interesting.
Icebreakers are also necessary for accessing the Antarctic. Those states are close to the South Pole. So if you look on the paper, you can see any of the boxed in ships are vessels that have been to the Arctic, with the exception of the U.S., Canada, Sweden, and Russia, and it looks like Germany. No, those other ships have been to the Arctic.
Excellent. That was my only question.
Clarification.
Reverend Isaacson.
Thank you. Arctic or Antarctic?
The Boston ships have been to the Arctic.
To the Arctic. So all the other boats, if you would, Mr. Chair, follow through. Finland and so forth, they should have been to the Arctic, but they haven't been to the Arctic?
Apologies. To be more specific, they've been to the North Pole. Through the chair, to answer the original question, I'm no expert on Argentina's use of icebreakers, so I'd have to get back to you. But I would suppose that those would be for Antarctic operations.
Follow up?
No, thank you.
It just amazes me. Looking at this chart here, very interesting, major icebreakers of the world, how many Russia has as compared to everybody else is kind of alarming. Any other questions from the committee? I don't want to do it this fast.
I know, it's no fun.
Representative Hughes.
I'm just noticing that Russia started building theirs back in the 60s, I see. They were busy at it. And the U.S. got quite a late start. I was just wondering what the history of the conversation has been in Alaska, whether we were back in the 60s beginning to encourage the U.S. to get going on it, or has this been more recent?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes. From my understanding, Alaska's congressional delegation has been fighting for more icebreakers for a very long time. It has only been relatively recent that the amount of melting in the Arctic has made this such a huge pressing issue to Alaska and America's Arctic interests. But I can get back to you with more specifics.
Mr. Chair, I'll just interject here, since the 60s were long before my intern was a glimmer in his parents' eyes. In the 60s, Alaska, of course, had just become a state. And one of the things that we're aware of is that the United States is only now realizing that they're an Arctic nation because of Alaska. So we are attempting to raise the urgency of the need for icebreakers. With the reducing Arctic ice, as many of you know, shipping lanes have opened up in the Arctic, and the Bering Strait is becoming quite a popular conduit for a lot of that shipping between Asia, the Arctic, predominantly Russia. And so this is another reason that we need icebreakers for national security.
Follow up.
Follow up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the cost of an icebreaker? And are there any private companies that are building them? And is it something that the state has considered as something that the state would build one and not wait for the federal government?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, as to your last question, I'm not familiar with the answer to that, but I can get back to you. But as to your first question, this was a question that came up in Senate Resources, and hopefully it was included in your packets. We outlined the prices for an icebreaker from the Senate Resources hearing on March 4th. And according to a high-latitude study provided to Congress in July 2011 and appearing in a December 2012 Congressional Research Service report, the cost for one ship would be about $856 million. And as the report goes up to six ships, with a total of $4.7 billion for six ships at an average of $784 million each. So, as to your second question regarding privately owned icebreakers, that major icebreakers of the world chart also shows some private icebreakers. The Nathaniel B. Palmer, along with the AVIC, or I believe that's how it's pronounced, AVIC, are both privately held.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I could interject just to flesh out the answer to that, the IVIC is actually owned by Royal Dutch Shell. It was harbored in one of my communities, Seward. It is now being transported, I believe, to Asia for retrofitting and some additional work, but that is privately owned. The Sikuliak, I believe you have, you may have information in your packet about the Sikuliak, which is a University of Alaska Fairbanks vessel. It's an Arctic research vessel, again, privately owned by the university, so to speak. It's not a multi-year ice-breaking capacity vessel. It's more of a research vessel, but it is Arctic equipped.
I see. And the icebreakers belong to the United States. What department of the government does that come under?
Mr. Chair, they are operated by the United States Coast Guard.
Yes, and whom do they report to? Is it Department of Defense? Is it the Treasury? Is it somebody else?
It would be the Department of Homeland Security.
Ah, good. I asked the same question the other day. At my age, I still thought it was the Treasury, which it was at one time. But it has evolved over a period of time. Okay, we have Representative Keller.
Yeah,
thanks. Vice Chair Keller.
Good job in your presentation. Would you give us kind of a review of where the council has met in the past and where it will meet in the future? I see in the guidelines that it rotates.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I do not have the exact locations by year. The chairmanship does rotate on a two-year basis. It began in 1996 with the chair being Canada, and then it rotated to the United States in 1998. And in 2015, I believe that's inside the resolution, it will rotate back to Canada. And let's see. On page 3 of the resolution, it speaks about this on line 18. Chairmanship of the Council will return to Canada, in 2013, and the United States will resume chairmanship of the council in 2015.
So. Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Do you know if the chairmanship is tied to where they meet, what country?
Through the chair. They meet inside the chairing country.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. That's fine. I was just wondering when we can expect the council in Alaska again, or if or when.
I have to go to Isaacson first and representing views.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since you asked for questions, I appreciate the maker of this resolution, and but I have several questions regarding its effectiveness. Number one, on page 2, it says Coast Guard does not have a base on or adjacent to the Arctic Ocean, which inhibits our ability. And then in the resolve on page 4, third resolve, it says it urges the United States to continue to assert political, strategic, environmental, and economic interests and such. So my couple questions are, what is the likelihood of us ever having a base in Alaska, in your estimation, from your research? And hinting at my research, the former Coast Guard captains have stated that Mid-America is not yet recognizing that we are an Arctic nation, and so because of the prohibitive cost of a Coast Guard icebreaker, it might be a long time before new ones are made. So what's the likelihood of this resolution gaining traction in Congress so that we can get basing, we can get new Coast Guard cutters and so forth? And I'll stop there and wait for your answer.
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, I would say that is our hope that this resolution would have a receptive audience inside Congress. Our congressional delegation has always been supportive of increasing the number of icebreakers in the U.S. Coast Guard fleet, and they've also been supportive of building Arctic posts for the Coast Guard. Just recently in 2012, Senator Begich co-sponsored an amendment to the Coast Guard Reauthorization Act that would prolong the lifetime of one of the aging polar icebreakers. So I'd say that the through measures like this, we can try to show the rest of the United States how important icebreakers are to the rest of the country and to America's Arctic interests.
Follow up.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. May I add some few things here to my aides' comments? I want to encourage all of the members of this committee to consider becoming active members of PENWAR, Pacific Northwest Economic Region, which has a subcommittee called Arctic Caucus. This group has been focused on these issues. It's Alaska, Northwest Territories, and Yukon. And out of Arctic Caucus came the idea or a lot of the momentum for the Northern Waters Task Force and ultimately the Arctic Policy Commission that Alaska has formed. Yes, we are facing, Representative Isaacson, some federal financial issues. And this is a very costly undertaking, not only the icebreakers, but an Arctic port. But if we never raise the concern, it will never happen. And we are raising the concern in Washington, D.C., with the Arctic Council's presence in the United States, our chairmanship of it. We are attempting to partner, so to speak, with Canada, who is taking over chairmanship of it in the near future, and really emphasizing the North American Arctic so that we can partner and perhaps more effectively leverage our presence. So you're right, it is a challenging uphill battle, but we're fighting it.
Follow up.
So thank you, and we must keep raising that as a challenge and as a standard. Awareness is important. So the resolution calls to have a member of the state of Alaska in its official delegation on the Arctic Council. Sometimes resolutions are brought forward at the request of, say, the Arctic Council, and other times it's done so that the entity will consider a new request. Which is this? Is this done in cooperation, or is this kind of knocking on the door saying, hello, don't forget us, can we come in, type thing?
Mr. Chairman, I'll take that question. It's knocking on the door, raising awareness. One of the things that Canada has done is their chair for their chairmanship is actually a woman, a diplomat, who is a native individual from Nunavut, which is one of their territories on the far north. And that's really, I think, an example for the United States. They have a northerner, Canada has a northerner sharing their position on Arctic Council, and that's what we're asking, that an Alaskan be considered for that position. Right now, Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell is the governor's designee and has been accepted as an official delegate, so to speak, or voice from Alaska to the federal government on Arctic issues. So we want to see that continue.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hughes.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember reading recently that the Arctic Council chairmanship has been currently in the last one or two terms by Norway, Finland, Sweden, and the emphasis, the policy emphasis included environmental protection, things like that. And now that Canada, it will be beginning chairmanship and followed by the U.S., as you said, there'll be an emphasis on North American issues. But I was delighted to see also that there was part of the emphasis would be on resource development and I believe perhaps shipping too. So I don't know if you have any more information of how the emphasis might change, but I'd be interested in that. And then the other thing I wanted to ask, I was wondering if there's support from the Western states, considering that they would be interested in the Arctic shipping route, it would seem to me, and if we have support from those Western states as far as increasing the number of ice cutters. Do we hear from them on this issue too?
Mr. Chair, I'll take that question. Representative Hughes, through the chair, your first question, what would the emphasis be? You're right, it is a very broad-reaching, Arctic Council has very broad-reaching focus, includes environmental, shipping, resource development. Our Arctic Policy Commission has actually divided into six subgroups. I happen to be chairing the natural resource and mineral development focus, and so I've been looking at the other Arctic nations in Arctic Council, and each of them really has a balanced perspective for each of these issues, transportation, development, environment, etc. So I think it's a very balanced group and view. As far as the Western states and their recognition of the importance of the Arctic, I actually am a member of another organization called Energy Producing States Coalition, which is predominantly Western states that produce energy. And I've been trying to raise their awareness of the importance of the Arctic, even to a state like Wyoming, who is shipping minerals potentially around the world, coal, for example. So it really falls to each of us as Alaska legislators to make our voices known to the other states as we go to these various meetings and belong to different organizations.
Thank you very much. excuse me. I believe Representative Millett, you objected for discussion, is that correct?
I remove my objection.
You remove objection. And the CS is, in fact, before the committee, and that's what we're going to be voting on. And I think we need to demonstrate to your intern what happens when we have a very controversial bill.
I object.
Like this. You object. So, so because of his objection, would you please call the roll?
Someone make a motion.
I move House CS for Senate Joint Resolution number 10, State Affairs 28-LS054/C from committee with individual recommendation, attached zero fiscal notes.
Fine. Call the roll, please.
Object.
Object.
Yeah, you object. I'm getting a green slip.
No.
Representative Isaacson?
Yes.
Representative Keller?
Yes.
Representative Millett?
Yes.
Representative Price Tompkins?
Yes.
Representative Gaddis?
Yes.
Representative Hughes?
Yes.
Chair Lim?
Yes.
Seven yeas, zero nays.
Thank you very much. This is passed from committee. Thank you very much for both of you presenting, and good luck on your university career. And you see what happens when we get a really controversial bill in front of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're going to add Eddie to do the paperwork. We're going to change our order of business and go to HCR 3.
And I don't have any of the CS.
We have
copy? The copies are out. I could put them out there, but I don't know if he gave you a copy.
Taking at ease. Will please come back to order. We are going to go to HCR number 3 on Joint Commission on Federal Overreach. And I would, you heard me testify, we need a motion to adopt the CS.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move CS for concurrent resolution number 3, version N is a working copy.
Okay, and without objection, would you please present the resolution?
Thank you. Good morning, members of the State Affairs Committee. My name is Sharice Millett. I represent House District 4 and also a proud member of this committee. Before you, you have the new revision of establishing a joint committee on access and federal overreach. After some discussions with Representative Keller and Representative Gaddis and Kafka and the governor's office, Randy Rarrow from the governor's office, we redesigned the CES to incorporate some of the things that the administration wanted, that Kafka wanted, and Representative Keller wanted, and made it into a more cohesive and broader group.
It's grown.
Yeah, it's grown, but it's grown in a really, really great way. Not only do we now, we have input from Kafka, we have input from the governor's office, we basically have now a clearinghouse that's going to come through the legislature so we can look at and decide what issues that we want to take on in a really good streamlined way of communicating to all 60 members of the body when something is happening in Alaska's land by the federal government, which we can either comment on, we can encourage the AG to take legal action on, or we can just start a letter-writing campaign, which sometimes, you know, changes the mind, like you'll see in Eisenbeck, which just happened. But I'll let my staff, Ike, explain the changes because there are many. And I believe at some point, Representative.
My name's Keller.
Well, I didn't know if I was waiting for you to nod. I might have an additional amendment that we didn't incorporate into the CS. Yeah, Representative Keller.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself and do your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ike Gilopsos. I'm a staffer to Representative Sharice Millett. And I want to apologize to this committee because when we first presented, I had the problem of jinxing this by saying what a simple resolution we're going to have before us, and Doug Gardner is probably taking migraine medication because of all the amendments I've sent his way in the last couple of days. And so we thank the committee for their indulgence. The explanation of changes, though numerous, are fairly simple in terms of their broad explanation, because when we look at the addition of the new whereases, beg your pardon, on page 1, line 8, on page 2, line 13, page 2, line 19, page 2, line 25, page 2, line 28, page 2, line 31, page 3, line 3, page 3, line 5, page 3, line 12. The language is very similar to what members of this committee would have seen at the beginning of this session with respect to the presentation that the Department of Natural Resources made with regard to federal overreach vis-a-vis not just RS-2477, but also abrogations of the state compact that the state of Alaska had when they entered into the union, expecting the 103 million plus acres, the controversies that ensued subsequent to that through measures such as ANILCA, the abrogation of the No More Lands Clause. When the initial presentation was made, the language in this resolution was a tad bit more opaque. This gives it a lot more substantive, specific language that deals specifically with access, right-of-ways, easements that affect residents of this state at the local level, at the statewide level. And in concurrence with what the concerns were of this committee, both from Representative Isaacson and Representative Gaddis, who had question, first of all, how do we deal with the deluge of all of this information coming towards us? And secondly, how do we vet legitimate concerns, exigent concerns, those which are pressing, those which perhaps are just belly aching? After conversating with Mr. Raro and Representative Keller, our office determined that when you look at the controversy surrounding RS-2477, what's pressing about that particular matter with regard to federal overreach is quite simply our sources of knowledge are dying out, because in order to validate those particular rights of way, you need to have individuals who can verify, who have used particular trails for subsistence use, for commercial use, and these predate statehood, and so we don't have the biological advantage at this point. And so we have to utilize all the technical and technological advantages, and being able to form a cohesive clearinghouse at a time when our state resources need to be consolidated is important from an internal component. But the second part of that whereas is that it is a stated policy under the current administration that the Bureau of Land Management is going to contest every RS-2477 application as an institutional policy. That's not a judgment call, whether that's a valid judgment on the part of the administration. That's simply a statement of fact, whereas previous administrations had more of a collaborative working environment between states who have RS-2477 applications and the Bureau of Land Management. This particular one is taking a harder stance. And that, coupled with those contingency factors we spoke to you earlier, really gives need for us to incorporate this into a body that can take action and can take action now. That takes care mostly of the whereas, and I think the familiarity of that language is embedded into the parts of the resolution. The second part that was added is under the resolved, and we added new subsections to the resolve at pages 3, line 26, page 3, line 31, page 4, line 4, page 4, line 11, page 4, line 14, page 4, line 19. And this was a confluence of two factors. The first was utilizing the language of Representative Keller's House Bill 83, which was a manner in which we recognize that the executive branch of our state government and the legislative branch of our state government need to have avenues of communication to share information in a direct way that doesn't impede the process of untangling a lot of these nitty-gritty questions. When you start talking about matters that are as granular as RS-2477 right-of-ways, or as important as simply trying to figure out the ratio of acreage that will allow a trade-off so that people who live in a village can have access to an emergency road, you need to be able to have input from all sides, from the various departments and the various divisions, to understand that there are no unintended consequences. And so this was meant to make sure that a committee wasn't overreaching, if you'll excuse the pun, but at the same time is using all the resources that are at their disposal and that's embedded in statute that gives them the institutional capacity to do so. Finally, what the purview of the committee was expanded to do was to talk about what Representative Christ Tompkins had brought up in the last meeting, which was, is there a forum by which the average citizen, non-legislative members can participate? And in utilizing the necessary public input on an RS-2477 as one component of that, this is a way in which if you're a resident of Hoona, if you're a resident outside of Tok, near Chicken, if you're outside of Kotzebue, you will have the ability to directly impact the process by which the precedent of having a right-of-way or an easement, private land access, village access, is determined. And we find that to be a good balance between the various stakeholders who at the local level want to see their input valued, and at the national level to understanding that the relationship between a state and a federal government maintains that balance between each other. And so we think that on the whole, after taking the input from the members of this committee and the members of the governor's office, we have found a substantial improvement through this. I believe that's the extent of the explanation of changes, Mr. Chairman.
Fine. Any questions? Very good. Any other comments you'd like to make, Representative Millett?
Chairman Lynn, no. Actually, I think that he did a superb job of explaining the changes and what we want to encompass. And this, I mean, I have no ownership in this resolution. I just want the committee to be formed, and I want it to be the best committee that we possibly can and have a huge impact on what we do and how we manage our federal overreach issue. I mean, I've taken on one, which is the legacy well issue. We have RS-2477 that has President Obama has flat out said there will be no more of those happening under his reign, so that means three more years of litigating. RS-2477, and that's a lot of work for our attorneys to do. I don't know if Randy Rara was here, but he brought into our office a packet that was probably this big, and it was just six roads. So I think Ike did a great job. So with that, I'll let committee discuss, and then Representative Keller, if you want to talk about your amendment.
Vice Chair Keller.
Yeah, thanks. First, I want to say thanks for the resolution. I frankly don't remember a resolution I've been as excited about as this one. I think you hit the nail right on the head, and I think it's really something important. The reason I'm going to offer amendment, and you and I have talked about this, and you know, you can reserve your rights to say yes or no, but I think you're with me on it, mm-hmm. is that it's not just a legislative issue. And I'm going to do is introduce a conceptual resolution with two whereases and a resolve here. And the two of the whereases simply acknowledges the number of people out there that are working on this issue, both in the administration and in the private sector. In the private sector, you've got groups like Alaska Outdoor Council, very engaged, very concerned about and subsistence issues, for example, you know, the federal interaction with how we handle subsistence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We got Alaska Health Commission, is spending a lot of time, a lot of effort on how to deal with responding to Obamacare. So it recognizes that there's a lot of groups out there, both public entities like the commissions and the working groups, the task forces out there, but also private groups and private individuals. And you all know, I think, about the Sturgeon case where the one individual is taking on the federal government, and now the Department of Law has joined him in trying to help him with that. So in the resolve section, to match that recognition, we can't tell the governor what to do, but we ask him if he'll please put together a working group that draws the expertise from the areas that we're aware of out there that are working about this, and then come up with some advice on how to put an entity in the administration to round out the standing committee that we've got going, so we have an administrative arm that can do the same thing, be a clearinghouse, and so that when we want to find out, for example, the summary of state of our different litigation issues, we've got one number to call, and people will ask and know it no matter what group you're in or whatever. So that's the concept of the amendment, and you all have a copy of it. And at the appropriate time, Mr. Chair, after the response from the sponsor, if she has one, I would like to offer that.
Do you have any response?
I like it.
You like it. Before we offer the amendment, is there anybody online you'd like to testify? Anybody in the audience would like to testify? If not, we're going to close public testimony, bring to the committee, and Vice Chair Keller, do you have an amendment?
I do. Before I do, I have forgotten now twice to acknowledge Randy Rara, who came over and told me that he couldn't be here because of a conflicting requirement to be over in the Senate side. He wanted to be here. He spent a lot of time on this, I know, with the sponsor and with me on this issue, and he's going to continue, I hope, to be an asset for us. I move, I guess it'd be amendment number one. It's labeled up in the corner U.A. You can cross that out. It's for N, version N. And it's a conceptual amendment, and you've all seen it, and you can see that there's work that needs to be done. I used acronyms. I didn't spell the words all the way out and that kind of thing, and I'm expecting the drafters and ledge drafters to take the concept and clean up the language a little bit. And
so we'll call that amendment number one.
I object.
Objection from
for discussion. Great, thanks. So if I could ask Representative Keller, on page 3, line 10, insert, what I'm lost. So I don't see where it would go, because that hits with global positioning system information pictures maps. I'm thinking maybe this was for a different version. Where would it go under the current version?
Like I say, it's a crude conceptual. I think what happened is my staff was looking at a different version.
Right.
That's a resolve, and I don't know where the drafter will put it in.
So is the intent, if I may, Mr. Chair, is the intent to not have the legislature form a joint committee on access and instead have the governor form a working group that is essentially the same composition but broadened.
Thank
as
you.
The joint committee would be?
Thank you for that question, Representative Isaacson. Not at all. This resolution is to form a standing committee to deal with this. And in the process of doing that, we're asking the governor to also respond with an administrative focal point clearinghouse in the administrative end.
Mr. Chair.
It is not a competition.
Reverend Isaacson.
Thank you. To follow up. So this working group in your amendment should consist of the leaders in the private sector, two legislators appointed by the Speaker of the House and President of the Senate. I take it that those two legislators then conceivably would be probably in the Joint Committee on Access and Federal Overreach?
Representative Isaacson, on my part, it would be just speculation. It could be that the Speaker and the President will choose to be on the initial group that forms the administrative end and then appoint somebody maybe to the to the standing committee. It is not at all preconceived. I frankly don't necessarily aspire to the job, just to put that on the record myself. I please don't think that that's my motivation, because it's not. I got enough to do.
Mr. Chair, follow up then.
Follow up.
So if it isn't going to have some cross communication, how is the governor's group and the joint committee going to effectively communicate if there's no cross pollinization directly?
Representative Isaacson, if I may, through the chair, I didn't spell that out, because I just presumed the normal interaction between the legislature and the executive branch, the administrative branch. No details. I would assume, for what it's worth, I would assume that there'd be rules that we make that apply to the standing committee if it's formed, and then the administration, if they put together an office of state sovereignty or whatever they want to call it, I would assume they would have regulations and whatever that would define those kind of things.
But follow up.
Brand. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would encourage us to amend your amendment somehow by insisting that the working group legislators, those that are appointed, actually be from the Joint Committee on Access, because I don't want to assume anything when it comes to the legislature and the administration, because we have no ability to predict the future of who's going to communicate. We can come back to an impasse between the legislature and the administration, as has been done in the past. And on other issues, we're already, I see, because there's not direct communication and the ability to shepherd issues, that sometimes we just, either on the legislative side or the administrative side, pencil whip procedures without true evaluation. And my hope would be that the members on the Joint Committee on Access and Federal Overreach will be passionate members about this, who will watchdog it, whereas someone who is working on the administrative side, as a, you know, they may do it just as a conciliatory measure without any passion, depending on who's governor at the time or whatnot. So I don't know how to conceptually amend a conceptual amendment.
Would you like to comment on that?
I would love to. I'd love
to see if somebody would like to make an amendment to the amendment.
Exactly, yeah. And I don't resist an amendment, a friendly amendment to the amendment, and I also see your concern, but I also have worked very closely, being a chair of CACFA, so I've worked closely with the people in the, for example, DNR and and the ELCA team, PAD, and the CACFA folks, and the and I know they have passion. You know, that's not a problem. And in my intent of including a legislator from both houses in this initial working group was merely, in fact, to ensure that that passion and engagement is there, because if they do it without us, then we're defeating the very thing that I'm trying to get at, which is a collaborative effort here, because that's the only way it's going to work, is if the admin, the legislature, and the private groups are all working together and singing out of the same songbook. So your intent is exactly right, and I'm not arguing against at all any clarification, and I would like, I see the sponsor of the comment. So.
And I'd like to get you in just a moment. Let me go to Representative Miller.
Thank you, Chairman. One of the things that we can't do with the governor, unfortunately, is tell him how to make up a committee. We can just suggest that he make a committee up, and that's why you know, it's in a resolution. And we would hope that he would appoint a legislator from the committee, but I think we want to be as broad as we possibly can based on that we're already going to have a standing committee, and it would be likely that he would appoint one. And I guess our being vague in the resolution about who the governor can appoint is not to push the governor into doing exactly what we want, but also having the creativity, if he did want the Speaker of the House and he did want the Senate President on that committee, and they were the two people that were going to communicate to the Standing Committee, that it be a more powerful group of working group. It would be a high-level working group. So we wanted to make sure that we had that option in there. So it didn't necessarily have to be from the Standing Committee, but if he wanted a high-level federal overreach working group within his administration, that the two appropriate people would be the Senate President and the Speaker of the House. It doesn't negate anybody from that Standing Committee being part of those meetings. And I think that you will find everybody in the legislature, just like myself, are pretty passionate about the federal overreach. But I'm uncomfortable spelling out to the governor what his committee should be. And I think that's why we left it pretty vague. And that was Randy's when we talked to Randy Barrow, that was his. You have to leave some power to the governor to appoint who he thinks appropriate. He might not think that two people from the Standing Committee is who he wants on it. So we didn't want to, in a resolution, boss around the governor, basically. So while I appreciate, and that is our intent, I just would hope that we could leave enough room in there for the governor to.
Care to respond?
Could I have one more clarification? Because then it might shape his response. It just occurred to me as I was listening that I didn't spell out verbally that the purpose of this working group is to come is to get ahead of the budget cycle for next fall. In October, they begin to work on the budget for the following year. And the idea is for this working group to make recommendations to the governor regarding what the governor can do on the administrative end, you know, and then if there's legislation that's required, it would be before us in 2014. So this is a very short-lived interim. I called it a working group, but you know, maybe that's not the appropriate term, but that's what we're asking for. That's and by the way, just so you know, that this wasn't just dreamt up in a silo or by me. I mean, there's been a lot of people working on this. There's been meetings with Randy Barrero on this issue in the governor's office, and it has included the executive director of CACFA. I've worked with Ed Fogles, who is the land person in DNR, and he understands and and is approving, as far as I can tell, of what we're doing. He hasn't seen the amendment. I don't mean to put words in his mouth, but he seemed very positive in encouraging in anything we can do to just send the word out that we really want the executive branch to act also parallel with this.
So that's not in there now?
What?
What you were just talking about?
No, it's there. It's the last couple
there.
Sentences. Yes.
Yeah.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In consideration of that, I was thinking broadly as this would be perhaps going on and on and on, because the administration of the current president will be continuing for longer than the administration of the current governor. That is an election cycle. But this says, and I appreciate Representative Millett's response as well. So this says, like Representative Keller was just saying, it is an immediate, by implication on line one, you might say to immediately form a working group, because there on line 8 and 9 of the conceptual, you've got that can be implemented in the next gubernatorial budget proposal for consideration in the 2014 legislative session. So with that in mind, I'll remove my idea of a conceptual amendment.
Thank you.
Just want to apologize for not making that clear because I can see your confusion. Thank you.
Reverend Hughes.
Thank you. I just
very patient. I'm sorry.
Oh, no problem. Thank the sponsor. I like it. I've already signed the green slip. And I'm Representative Keller, appreciate your amendment. I like it as well. But I wanted to ask, and just so I understand correctly, CACFA, what does that stand for again? And how would the working group be different from that? And then whether it would be one of Representative Isaacson's concern was that how the working group would integrate with the joint committee, and I was wondering if it might be appropriate. They would here in your conceptual amendment, the recommendations would be implemented in the next gubernatorial budget. Would it be appropriate for that working group to provide its recommendations to the joint committee, and would you be open to that? So rather than just budget items, there would actually the joint committee would get more of a sense of the discussion and recommendations of the working group.
Reverend Keller.
I'll have to think about how that would affect it. When I wrote it, I was thinking that the standing committee does not exist until this passes, and there's a possibility that this amendment, this resolve, will have an impact even if the resolution as a whole would fail just by getting the information out there, you know. And so getting into the details of how the reporting goes, I thought it would get reported in the normal budget request process because they have to come to us for the money if they're going to build a office of Alaska sovereignty, a protection that reviews the compact and keeps track of these things. I'm assuming there would be a fiscal impact and there would be cost. And that's why I want to get ahead of the budget cycle. And at that point, that would define the communication between that temporary interim working group and the legislature. And then that would go away. And then what would have to be defined, of course, is the, and it already is by the standards that we use, the interaction between our standing committee and the executive branch. So does that help?
I appreciate that, and I could see where if it was specifically a budget request that the legislature and the joint commission or joint committee would definitely those recommendations would come through. But if it were some recommendation that didn't involve a fiscal matter, then I'm not sure that would come through. So that would be my concern. And also, again, CACFA, what does it stand for, and how does it compare to what you're suggesting?
I forgot the first part of your question. I'm sorry. CACFA stands for the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas. So it largely deals with it's a group of commissioners that have been put together from all across the state, and we meet three or four times a year. And what we do is keep track of the actions of the U.S. parks, you know, and the wild and scenic rivers, you know, the dynamics that go on with those, the forest, BLM, and forestry, U.S. forestry, and NOAA, you know, our endangered species impact comes in, you know. So we have these federal agencies operating in the state of Alaska. As you know, over 60% of the land is federal land. And we have guarantees in this state on access to natural resources in spite of the fact that they own so much land. So what CACFA does is works to ensure that we hang on to those rights that were given to us specifically by an ELCA, which is a federal act, that our Constitution is abided by and all that. So what happens is CACFA goes through what they call the Federal Register regularly and finds actions that have to get posted public information by these federal agencies, and then we monitor where they are imposing on Alaskan rights to access. And it happens more regularly than I am comfortable with. I'm very amazed at how blatant they are. We even had I don't want to name him because I might get this a little wrong, but conceptually basically said the contract that we had when we became a state doesn't really affect what U.S. Parks does. And we have that in writing, you know, that's the way they view it. And I think that is blatantly, wrong. And that's the kind of thing CACFA does, is look for that kind of thing. We write letters. We recommend to the AG when there's litigation that is we feel is appropriate. One of them, for example, is the Sturgeon case, the one on the access through Yukon Charlie, and a number of them that we try to follow carefully what the AG's office is doing on federal litigation. And frankly, there's more that can be done than can possibly be done by one group. I mean, just in that one area of federal areas, dealing with federal areas, our director, excuse me for going on, but she pulled my chain, Mr. Chair. Our executive director last year, I think, went through a, he said he estimated, he and his staff estimated 14,000 pages, of compendiums. This is rules that are made by, for example, our U.S. Parks superintendents that are up here. And sometimes these superintendents, they're well-meaning, wonderful people, but they just simply aren't aware of how unique Alaska is and how unique our rights are in Anoka. For example, we have access to hunting and fishing on federal land that, like a U.S. Parks, and let's use that one, that in another state wouldn't be valid. But up here, it's okay because we have that right guaranteed to us in Anoka. And so that's what CACFA does. It monitors that kind of thing. And that's just one corner. We have I also mentioned Anoka team in DNR, and they do nothing but, monitor the Anoka law. And then we have the PAD, which is working on the RS-2477 accesses, and they go out, and a lot of work being done there. And they're just, the Health Commission, the amount of work that in respect. So it's not just CACFA is my point, but CACFA is one.
I think as well said, we do want to be careful, all of us, when we use these acronyms, we do have, a viewing audience who may not be as familiar as we are here, and even some of us are not familiar with it. So, I used to watch Gavel to Gavel before I was in the legislature, and I didn't know what they're talking about half the time because of all these acronyms being used, and we may want to do some legislation on outlawing acronyms. I don't know. Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up to that, I am guessing that our state is probably more assertive and has more things going in this area than other states, but I'm not sure of that. So I don't know if Representative Keller, the sponsor of the resolution, would like to comment to that. Are we ahead of the game? Are we doing more than other states? Is there something that other states are doing that we also could be doing?
I'm delighted to answer that. Unfortunately, in some areas we're way behind. The state of Utah is doing wonderful things, and we're working with them and monitoring what they're doing and joining them in briefs and whatever, and specifically in the area RS-2477 right-of-ways. I think Alaska is strong in the sense that there's a lot of people concerned, but I think we're very weak in the fact that we have not collaborated and put our power together to go on this, and that's exactly why I brought this amendment before us.
Very good.
Chairman, can I make some
comment, please?
That's a really good point, Representative Hughes, and I think you saw Senator Giesel earlier talked about the Energy Producing State Coalition. That's exactly why that group was formed, was to collaborate with other states, and out of that have come from other legislators a support on ANWR. We've supported Keystone Pipeline. We've been collaborating on like legislation that will not only help Alaskans and the American economy, but other states get what they need. So it's starting. It's really slow. It's starting, but there is the Energy Producing States Coalition. Also in the U.S. Senate, there's a Western States Coalition that our delegation belongs to, and they collaborate on things. There's also in the House, it's called the House Energy Action Team, and they look at things like this too. But until we identify all those groups, until we have an entity that can identify those groups and ask them to come before a committee, we would have them, they could come before judiciary, they could come before state affairs, they could come before resources. So what this does is I think it really does give the legislature the power to get information. have committee meetings, have the Department of Natural Resources come before us and tell us what's going on. I think it is the communication that we need. You talk about linkage, where our linkage would be. Our linkage would be with this committee because we could have oversight or overviews of, you know, anything you wanted to have in the committee, because the whereas and the resolves are so broad that we're doing with this committee, that we would have, you know, any land use issues, any federal overreach issues. I think this is the linkage that we are all looking for and looking at as a joint committee that meets on a regular basis and deciphers information, much like this committee meets on state affairs issues. This would be the same committee, and this would be the location where we would, the nexus that you're looking for, Representative Isaacson, on where that information all comes.
So. If committee is ready, who made the objection to the
amendment? I'll remove my objection.
Any other objection? If not, amendment number one, I believe, has passed. Anybody else online? Anybody in the audience? Okay. If not, then, any closing comments or anything? It will bring us to a conclusion, we hope.
I think we've talked it to death.
Good. Well, I think it's a good build. I'm ready for a motion.
Good. Mr. Chair, I'd move the CS for House Concurrent Resolution Number 3, version in November, as amended, out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Okay. Without objection, the bill moves. We are at ease until we do the paperwork. Will you please come back to order? Our next order of business is a CS for House Bill Number 59. I need to have a motion to adopt the CS. Am I got it wrong here?
Mr. Chair,
Is it Y?
I have it.
Yeah,
it's Y.
Y.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I move CS for House Bill 59, version Y, as our working document.
Okay, without objection, we're working with Representative Isaacson.
No, I have it. Thank you.
Okay. Welcome, Representative Grunberg. Introduce yourself, please. Welcome back to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank the members of the committee. I'm Max Grunberg from House District 14, and my assistant.
Miles Brooks, Staff Representative Grunberg.
And would you tell us differences on the CS as compared to the previous bill, please?
Yes, sir. I hope that you've received a little memo dated March 26 that mentions the single change, and that is the addition of the text on page 2, lines 22 through 29, which puts back into the bill tort immunity for state action under this. In the original bill, which was the A version, this language appeared. As we worked the bill in Military and Veterans Affairs, there was a misunderstanding, and I thought the administration wanted us to delete the state tort immunity. So in the current previous version, there was no provision like that, only immunity for broadcasters. Since then, the administration has come and said we'd like the tort immunity back in. We have two witnesses today to answer questions. Number one is Mike O'Hare. I'm not sure it's going to be necessary to ask him anything, but Rodney Dial from Public Safety is prepared to testify that yes, the administration would like the tort immunity back.
Yes, we have both these folks online that are available for questions. Would the sponsor like us to call them now? Excuse me, Reverend Christ Tompkins.
To clarify, who is Mike O'Hare?
Mike O'Hare is from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, because they are doing the communications initially to Public Safety to set up this network.
Yeah, let's call him now. Mr. Hare, are you online?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Mike O'Hare.
Somebody turn up the volume.
Homeland Security and Emergency Management for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. As a plea to the committee, I'm available to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. O'Hare? Okay, not at this time. Thank you for being available. Lieutenant Rodney Dial, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Lieutenant Rodney Dial. I'm a lieutenant with the troopers stationed out of Ketchikan. And the department is supportive of the changes and adding immunity back into the bill, and I'm available for questions.
Any questions, Lieutenant Dial? Vice Chair Keller.
Yeah, Rodney, I think all of us are very supportive of a silver alert, just to give it an overall view. This is a first, as I see the law, it is a first as far as legislating a particular group of people for you to build a plan for. I know you don't mind because you do this already. Do you have any concern about this generating other legislation, other groups that you have to write plans for?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, the department envisions that this would create a plan that would provide notifications to the media via like an email, phone, or fax system, and we could potentially use the regional dispatch centers to receive the information and send out the notifications. We do not believe that the number of notifications that this bill would generate would impact the department in a significant manner. So we really do not have any concerns with this legislation.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Lieutenant Dial. Thank you, sir. Any other questions? Representative Millett, that's Lieutenant Dial? Or
Mike, we're here.
Mr. Hare, are you there still?
Still here, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Representative Millett, I believe, has a question.
Hi, Mike. My question is how many times, and I don't know, maybe this will go back to the sponsor too, how many times have we had the need, if this bill was in place, say 5 years, how many silver alerts would we have had? I know of a couple that were in the paper, but whenever there's someone missing, we don't always see a newspaper report about it. So how many vulnerable adults do we have that would you think that the silver alert would apply to from a historical perspective?
Representative Miller, through the chair, I would like to pass the buck respectfully to Lieutenant Dial to answer that question. I think it was stated previously, there aren't many instances where this would be in place.
Okay. Mr. O'Hare, are you still there?
No. Representative Dial.
Lieutenant Dial. Mr. Chairman, this is Lieutenant Dial.
I beg your pardon, Lieutenant Dial.
To answer that question, my anecdotal experience would be that we're probably talking that maybe six a year or fewer. As far as public safety goes, there may be more concerning the municipalities. It would be hard for me to comment on that. I can tell you that many of these are resolved fairly quickly. So part of the discussion that the department would have with the Department of Military Veterans Affairs when we created this response plan would have to be consideration of, you know, how much, what investigative steps and efforts and how much time would elapse before we make immediate notification. Because in many cases, we can mobilize resources fairly fast, go out to a neighborhood where a qualifying individual would be missing, and in just a few minutes, hopefully, resolve that. And that's how most of these are resolved fairly quickly. But so I think the actual number on an annual basis in the state, including the municipalities, would most likely be less than a dozen.
I'd say. Thank you. Representative Hughes, and then Isaacson.
As follow-up to Representative Millett's question through the chair, Lieutenant Dial, those six that you mentioned a year, those all wouldn't be going statewide, would they? Some of those would be resolved at a local level before it would go out on a system statewide. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct. We would envision that this would be more a local notification versus statewide notification.
Thank you.
Thank you. Lieutenant Isaacson.
Thank you. Lieutenant Dial, the provisions that are being put back in here, giving you some indemnity, when would you consider that it would not be necessary to participate or implement a missing vulnerable adult prompt response and notification plan?
Through the chair, part of our discussion in developing a plan would have to we would have to be mindful of those situations in which people would try to abuse the plan. For example, the department receives a number of calls in a year from people that are reporting somebody missing who have actually intentionally left and just simply don't want to be found. For example, a domestic situation between a boyfriend and girlfriend. Boyfriend goes to work and comes home from work and his girlfriend has left. And we have to be able to kind of weed out those cases where somebody will try to use the system or report somebody missing when they're actually really not missing. And so those would be some liability concerns that we would have. You know, we have to be very careful that somebody wouldn't manipulate or abuse the system, and then all of a sudden somebody who's intentionally left maybe a domestic situation now has their notification on the TV that they're actually missing vulnerable adults. So it's just one potential example of something that we have to plan for and be careful of.
Very good. Thank you.
This is one of the concerns I voiced at the last hearing on this bill, I think. You know, to determine what is a missing person in the classic sense, what's a vulnerable adult who's gone missing? President Isaacson.
No, that's very helpful, and I appreciate the latitude we're giving the department then to make a determination such as this. And I could see that if we didn't have this in here, that they could be sued for not promptly acting, and that would be a frivolous lawsuit, although maybe by a very emotionally harried individual. I just don't want to see also, you know, I have some staff that are getting older who like to fish, and one day he may be fishing and his kids might have a concern that he's not where he's supposed to be, but he's intentionally gone fishing, so. But no, I appreciate the answer and the consideration. Thank you.
Comment from Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, thank you. Just on this point, I think it may have been the thinking when we talked, and I'm not sure which department talked with me about taking it out, that the Little Tort Claims Act in Title IX, which generally provides the circumstances under which you can sue the state for a tort, would cover this. And it would in certain cases, thinking about it, if it's a discretionary act. Discretionary acts are immunized against the state. But then you would get into a circumstance where somebody could argue, well, it's not discretionary. You have to put this out. And this putting it back in, I support, even though I'm not a great fan of immunities generally, because these people have to act quickly, and we don't want a bunch of people, even in my profession, saying, you should have done this, you should have done that. If in doubt, we leave it to the professionals. They have no time to make a decision, and they've got to have the discretion to do that.
Thank you, Representative Miller.
Thank you. Representative Grunberg, your definition of vulnerable adult is 18 years of age or older who, because of physical or mental impairment, is unable to meet the person's own needs or to seek help without assistance. So that would take out the boyfriend-girlfriend kind of situation, because if they're not physically or mentally impaired, then they wouldn't be considered under the silver alert. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So that would take out the worry of having a malicious call.
That's the intent.
Okay. And then that would also follow up. Thank you. That would also include anybody with the language changes that we did earlier this year, the R word, so we could put.
Oh yeah.
Mentally or
yes,
intellectually
of
disabled?
Of course.
Okay.
Certainly.
Okay.
Your bill.
Fine, thank you. Any other questions from the committee? If not, anybody online? Anybody in the audience want to testify? We'll close public testimony. Any comments or questions from the committee? If not, I'll entertain a motion.
I'd just like to add, if it's a friendly amendment, if the sponsor would not mind changing that description of vulnerable adult to length.
Reverend Grunberg doesn't mind amendments.
Yeah, no. It's just a small technical one, Max. To change the language to match the language that we now have in statute on mentally on the disabled. So the statute would be the same description. Instead of the mental impairment, we would use the correct definition that we
I would consider that a great amendment.
Okay.
Okay. Would you make the amendment, the conceptual amendment, please?
The conceptual amendment would be to, in line 6, change mental impairment to intellectual and developmental disabled.
Page 3. And do we have any other amendments previous to this? So this would be amendment number 1, would it?
Right.
Right,
that would be conceptual amendment number 1. Reverend Greenberg?
It's on page 3, line 6.
Page 3, line 6. Remove mental impairment, but actually, yeah, just mental impairment, and add intellectually and developmentally disabled.
Did you get that over here? Mm-hmm. Okay, fine. Any objection? Aye. If not, amendment number 1, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Passes committee. Any other questions or comments?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Keller, Vice Chair Keller.
I'd like to move CS for House Bill 59, version Yankee, out of the committee with attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendations as amended.
Thank you very much. It passes from committee. We don't have the schedule yet ready for this committee for Tuesday. We'll have it together later this afternoon. Any questions, you contact my office before we adjourn for the day. With that, thank you, everybody, for participating. We are adjourned.
I object.